Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5HETIDE.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5HETIDE.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.
Welcome back to the Barbell Medicine Podcast, where we bring modern medicine to strength and conditioning and strength and conditioning to modern medicine. I'm your host, Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum. This is episode 282. March 2024 research review, where we review popular papers in the mainstream media and cool research that comes our way. In this episode, we're talking about, does consuming artificially sweetened beverages increase the risk of a heart condition called atrial fibrillation, the effect of anabolic steroid use on longevity, and are plastics a health hazard? On the other end of the line, I have the second most handsome doctor in North America, Dr. Austin Baracchi. What's going on, dude?
Hey, I'm doing good. What's up with you? How's training?
I mean, training has been bad. Not because I'm weak or, you know, it's just been going sideways. My hand has betrayed me. I have this Dupuytren's nodule on my third flexor tendon, and it's painful. It's right in the middle of my palm. So here's the interesting thing. I can squat no problem. That doesn't interfere with that. If I deadlift with straps, it's tolerable to about 500 pounds, and then I have to squeeze hard enough where I'm like, this is okay. Uncomfortable. I mean, I could look money on the line. I could do it, but I don't want to. And then bench press. Oh boy.
Intolerable.
Intolerable. And it's weird. So I was like, all right, well, what about dumbbell work? Terrible. Like I just can't, like if I have to like, squeeze on that. And then I was like, all right, what about a machine?
I can do chest press. Yeah.
The problem, I think it's just like whenever I have to push hard against something, I adopt the same grip I normally would. And so I'm talking with Mike T about making a 3D printed like handle, like adaptive handle, where it's almost like a flat surface I get to like push against. Because I could do it like that. But
or
anyway.
Put a cutout in the piece of plastic right over the nodule in your palm.
Yeah. Well, so I ordered some fat grips and I hollowed out one of them so where I'd have like a relief for my little nodule. It also, the other thing, it kind of sucks when I play golf. And then when I put my hand on handlebars for motocross, it also hurts then. So I'm just, it's not good. I don't like it. I'm going to go see a doctor about this.
Yeah, talk to your friend, the hand surgeon. See what he says.
I did. Yeah. So I have a plan of action. I just, the idea of me managing it myself, what's the saying? Like doctors who have themselves for a patient are dumb. Same thing as like lawyers who represent themselves are dumb, something to that effect. Yeah, I feel that. So anyway, how are things going with you?
Okay. My training, as I've alluded to, and I know we'll probably talk about in more detail sometime soon, has gone in quite a different direction, but I'm doing pretty high frequency, but lower volume lifting training, doing time on the rower, actually doing a couple runs a week. And I'm feeling all right. So
nice.
We'll keep rolling with it.
Yeah. I forgot to mention some of the modifications I've been making. All right. So like I can squat like relatively heavy, so that's fine. But deadlifting relatively heavy is challenging, but hip thrusts are fine. Also, I've been doing a lot of heavy sled work, both pulling and pushing. Mm-hmm. So like kind of rope to it. I can do that, I guess, because it's just so big, like my hand doesn't irritate the area. But also like dragging a heavy sled forwards and backwards, I'm under no illusion that this is going to increase my squat or my deadlift or really build a significant amount of, you know, leg size or strength. It just allows me to work hard without hurting me, which,
yeah.
Anyway.
You know, maybe have these strategies. I recently finished up writing a draft article kind of in this vein relating to some rehabby related topics that is currently undergoing editing and hopefully goes up within the next, I don't know, week or so. So
nice.
I look forward to that too.
Nice. Yeah. If, you know, this hand thing doesn't go away, I guess we'll just, you know, we'll have a bunch of adaptive stuff on the website because I'll just have to write it from my own perspective. But
there you go.
All right. Let's pop into the main subject for this week's podcast. Again, this is the March 2024 research review. The first study we're going to talk about is titled Sweetened Beverages, Genetic Susceptibility, and Incident Atrial Fibrillation, a Prospective Cohort Study. This was done by Sun et al. And a research group out of Shanghai. This was published in the Circulation Journal, March 2024. All right, so just some background. Let's start off with what is atrial fibrillation. Austin, you want to give people just a lay of the land about what is AFib or atrial fibrillation?
Yeah, this is a term that folks may have heard in, I don't know, maybe TV commercials or related to certain medications and things like that. It fundamentally relates to an irregular heart rhythm. So if you put your hand over your heart or you feel your pulse, if you have a normal heart rhythm, it'll be this regular, almost like on a metronome. You could predict when the next beat is going to come. There are various conditions that can lead to an irregular heart rhythm. Atrial fibrillation is just one of them. And it's a situation where it beats in a much more irregular and unpredictable fashion, sometimes super fast, sometimes super slow, sometimes at a normal rate, but just kind of unpredictably. This can be due to structural changes in the heart, mainly if people have issues with their heart valves or certain other issues, or it can come from other things that are not necessarily due to the structure of your heart, but other things that can affect the heart negatively, the most common of which is probably alcohol use. And then also we see it frequently in patients with obesity, metabolic syndrome, diabetes, sleep apnea. Many of the same topics that we've talked about in previous podcasts all increase the risk and predispose to developing atrial fibrillation and other cardiovascular complications. And the reason we care about it outside of, you know, situations where the rate of your heart rate goes way too high or way too low, which is less common, is just that when you have this irregular rhythm, blood can pool a little bit for longer than it would normally in certain chambers of your heart. And when blood sits too long, it can form a clot, and that clot can get ejected out of your heart to various parts of your body. It can go up to your brain. It can go down your aorta to your, you know, to your spleen, to your kidneys, to your legs, and those clots can get lodged and cause injury and death to those areas. Like, for example, it can cause a stroke in the brain. And so we reduce the risk of a stroke in patients with atrial fibrillation by putting them on blood thinners. And then the other thing is, depending on how debilitating or how symptomatic the person is, we tend to more aggressively control their heart rate, their heart rhythm, although, you know, there's been a lot of back and forth over the years. I would say in recent years, we much more aggressively try to get people out of atrial fibrillation and into a normal rhythm, but that's not always feasible for all patients.
Got it. All right. So that's the lay of the land about what is AFib. Now, it's important to know that this is pretty common. The estimated global sort of burden of AFib was in 2010 was 33.5 million people. It's going up, though, so it's likely much higher than that. And this is mostly due to an aging population worldwide. It's more common in men, more common in white individuals. And again, like I said, it's increasing. And the important thing to note here is that there's been a 22% increase in men in the UK over the last decade or so, and about a 14% increase in women. And this is important because the data set we're talking about is from the United Kingdom. All right. So just again, pretty common irregular rhythm of the heart. It is increasing. It is increasing, especially in the population that we're going to talk about in this study.
I'll add one comment before we move on, because the diagnosis of it is a little bit tricky. And so this idea of what is the prevalence might be a little bit complicated. And the reason I say that is that, you know, like a lot more people these days are using wearables and Apple Watches and things like that that can detect and alert you to irregular heart rhythms like atrial fibrillation. The issue is that a lot of people can very briefly have short bouts of atrial fibrillation pop in and out of it. And we don't necessarily know the significance of somebody having, like, you know, a very, very short run of it compared with, we do know that if somebody lives in it all the time, that that's very high risk. And so there's probably a spectrum of risk in between. And so there's probably a fair number of people out there who have little bouts of it, or may even have it and have no symptoms at all. And so we don't know they have it. I imagine that in part, the prevalence is increasing. Population increase, aging increase, metabolic syndrome, diabetes, obesity increase, all that stuff. But also there's some component of it, you know, I would say a much smaller fraction that people are detecting because they're like wearing Apple Watches and they're getting alerted to it when they would have had no symptoms and never would have known about it. And if it's a very brief run, it may be of no real significance either.
When you see like history of paroxysmal atrial fibrillation on somebody's chart, what does that make you think of?
Yeah, it just makes me want to dig into it and figure out, where did that come from? What was that based on? And should this person be treated with things like blood thinners or not? Because that could be a very consequential decision for somebody if it's going to be lifelong.
Yeah. Okay. So that's the story on AFib. Now, again, we're trying to figure out, like, does the consumption of artificial sweeteners, in this case, artificially sweetened beverages, does that actually increase the risk of having atrial fibrillation? And so what is an artificial sweetener? We've talked about this in a number of different podcasts, but there are many different artificial sweeteners. Not all of them are the same. They all have unique chemical structures with varying levels of sweetness, and they are processed differently in the body. They've been used for a long time. So like Equal has been around since the 1960s. That's aspartame, and saccharin to sweeten low, basically since 1879. Actually, super interesting tie-in with saccharin and that book I just finished called The Poison Squad.
Was it Teddy Roosevelt? Yeah. I forget which president it was who really wanted to use it, and he was being recommended against using it, and he was like, I'm not listening to you.
I need this. I must have it. As far as the, you know, how many people are consuming what we would call non-nutritive sweeteners, so these are effectively just calorie-free sweetening agents, the consumption is estimated to have increased by about 200% in children and adolescents and 54% in adults between 1999 and 2000. So that's over 20 years ago. I would say it'd be very unlikely that anybody not only listening to this podcast, but globally in developed societies have not been exposed to a non-nutritive sweetener. It'd be highly unlikely, but it's possible, of course. Okay. There are 8 non-sugar sweeteners currently approved for use in foods in the U.S. and Europe. 2 of them are, quote, natural. So it's like stevia and derivatives of stevia, and also monk fruit extract. It's unclear if these were actually included in the study, by the way, because they specifically go out of their way to say artificially sweetened beverages. And so if you were being, very pedantic, you'd say, well, I can't include those. But unclear if they actually did or didn't. And there are 6 synthetic ones. So this includes Ace K. So that's stuff like Sweet One or Sunet. Aspartame, again, that's Equal or NutraSweet. There's Neotame, Advantame, Saccharin, which is Sweet and Low, and Sucralose, which is Splenda. Again, those would just be considered the artificial sweeteners, but it's unclear in this study if they just limited it to those 6 or if they also included stevia, monk fruit extract, et cetera. As far as the lay of the land with respect to artificial sweetener, or as I'll refer to them, non-nutritive sweetener intake and health, there's been a lot of kind of talk about this recently. In May of last year, in 2023, the World Health Organization, they released a new guideline on these non-sugar sweeteners, which recommends against using them for body weight control or to reduce the risk of non-communicable diseases, things like heart disease, type 2 diabetes, and so on. There is existing data, pretty good data in my estimation, for those who replaced foods with added sugars in their diet with non-sugar sweetened food. Well, it reduces their energy intake by about 136 calories per day. It reduces their sugar intake by about 38 grams per day. These are generally beneficial. People lose weight, reduce their sugar intake, disease processes improve. Now, that's in the short term, though, when they're doing these sort of controlled experimental studies. The problem is most long-term data sets, sort of analyzing non-nutritive sweetener intake and health, they don't measure the replacement of foods with added sugars with non-nutritive sweeteners. They just try to estimate the consumption of non-nutritive sweeteners in and of itself. So you don't really know the behavior, like what's going on there. Non-nutritive sweeteners are also found in lots of ultra-processed foods that are generally high in calories, high in added sugars. You can have them together, high in added sodium and high in added fats. So that can be a confounding factor if somebody's consuming a lot of non-nutritive sweeteners or artificial sweeteners, but is also consuming a lot of ultra-processed foods. You would predict that would be generally poor dietary pattern, for example. So the long-term data on artificial sweeteners from a health perspective is confounded markedly by the way it's being measured, and particularly the behaviors, food-related behaviors. I can see where the WHO was coming from. They're like, look, man, the existing data doesn't show a big health benefit here. And I would agree with them. It doesn't. But that's a limitation to the data, in my estimation, not because like artificial sweeteners, or like I prefer to refer to them as non-nutritive sweeteners, are particularly dangerous. So if someone's replacing foods with added sugars with non-nutritive sweeteners, or foods with non-nutritive sweeteners in general, I'm in favor of that, unless those foods still contain added sugars on top of that, and are, again, are ultra processed in general. We talked about that in May, in the research review from May of last year.
And then more recently, we talked about it in reference to the SWITCH trial. Now, this was a study that lasted for a year. It was basically comparing the intake of water only or non-nutritive sweeteners, artificially sweetened beverages, and the effect on weight loss. So there was a 12-week active period of weight loss, and then they would see how the two different groups maintained the weight loss for the next 40 weeks, so to the completion of a year. So the weight loss with the non-nutritive sweeteners was 7.5 kilos, and then it was 6.1 kilos with the water only. Now, this was barely statistically significant, but, you know, one in favor of non-nutritive sweeteners. And again, they increased their weight more, but also their waist circumference more than just the water-only group. And again, that was statistically significant.
If you thought that there was going to be like some untoward outcome from consuming a lot of non-nutritive sweetened beverages, well, it should have shown up in this point. And it didn't really matter if these folks regularly consumed non-nutritive sweetened beverages or artificial sweeteners or not. It just this seemed to persist regardless. Also, the waist circumference was reduced more in the folks consuming non-nutritive sweeteners compared to water alone, and that again was statistically significant. So before we talk about this actual study, the lay of the land here based on the quote barbell medicine interpretation of artificial sweeteners. Artificial sweeteners aren't essential to health, nor are they uniquely health promoting, but they also don't appear to be uniquely harmful either. Any risk, I think, that is attributed to non-nutritive sweeteners is probably due to the co-occurrence in ultra-processed foods and a generally poor dietary pattern, not the non-nutritive sweetener itself. Still, overall, at a population level, I think it's, you know, a reasonable recommendation to say that diets shouldn't be that sweet. If the diet is very sweet, it likely contains a lot of food and beverages with added sugars or a lot of artificial sweeteners in from ultra-processed foods. And so I think if you just wanted to say, hey, the diet shouldn't be that sweet, don't consume a lot of extra sweeteners, I think that's fine. But to say that artificially sweetened beverages or artificially sweetened foods or just non-nutritive sweetener consumption in general is like deleterious or harmful to someone's health, well, that's a reach in my opinion. Austin, you agree with that?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, we've seen the pendulum swing all over the place, but even so far as like, you know, soda companies deliberately promoting or you know, producing and promoting like natural sugar products or cane sugar products with the idea that, of course, if you label it as an artificial sweetener, people just have this, you know, aversion, suspicion to quote unquote artificial things, and it natural sugar might sound better. But I don't think either of us would advise that people go out of their way to consume added sugar, even if it is quote unquote natural sugar, over the use of a non-nutritive sweetener in the diet on a habitual basis.
Yeah, I agree. So this particular study, now this is a prospective cohort study where the researchers assessed the individual's dietary patterns at baseline using a food frequency questionnaire and at multiple intervals throughout the data collection period. And basically, we're trying to see if there was a connection between the particular variable or set of variables in this case. So that's artificial sweet beverage consumption, sugar sweetened beverage consumption, and or a genetic risk score, and the outcome of interest, in this case, atrial fibrillation risk. They used the UK, United Kingdom Biobank data. This is a nationwide data set from the United Kingdom consisting of over 500,000 people aged 37 to 73. In this particular study, they started out by including just over 200,000 people. Others of the data set were missing dietary recall questionnaires, didn't have genetic polygenic risk score data, for example. And then they cut that down to just over 140,000 people because they eliminated any family members. So they basically didn't want kinship to sort of sway the results for the genetic risk ratios. As far as beverage consumption, again, this was assessed via a 24-hour food frequency questionnaire. Basically, it's a questionnaire that asks you to look back over the previous day and say, hey, how much of these things did you eat? And sugar sweetened beverages were considered fizzy drinks and squash. Austin, have you ever heard of squash as
Never
a drink?
Heard of it. Nope.
So this is like a fruit-based syrup that you add water or soda to, kind of like a cordial, if you will.
Oh, sure.
So,
okay.
Yeah. So you have some of that at home. If you just added it to some water or like a Topo Chico, you'd have a squash. I'd never seen this term outside of vegetable or like a particular type of racquetball. So I was like, wait, what is squash? So that was sugar sweetened beverages. Artificially sweetened beverages, they classified as low calorie drinks, but the authors don't go into great detail over this. And this we should contrast to some of the other studies like the switch trial we referred to earlier on weight loss, which was no calorie drink. So effectively a diet soda has no calories in it, for example. They also did another analysis on pure fruit or vegetable juice, which we'll completely ignore because the results there aren't interesting. And they eliminated milk, tea, or coffee ingestion from exposure, despite folks usually, particularly in the UK, adding sugar or potentially non-nutritive sweeteners to those beverages. They separated exposure into four separate categories. So 0 liters per week, no exposure effectively to either sugar sweetened beverages or artificially sweetened beverages. Less than 1 liter, so not zero, but not a lot. 1 to 2 liters per week, and then greater than 2 liters per week. And the atrial fibrillation diagnosis was obtained by linkage to the medical, their medical record. So effectively, they were diagnosed in a clinic. They looked up these people and said, oh, got AFib or you didn't. The genetic risk was measured by what's known as a polygenic risk score, which represents the total number of genetic variants that an individual has to assess their heritable risk of developing, in this case, atrial fibrillation. There are a number of potential confounders. Like Austin was alluding to, there are many risk factors for developing atrial fibrillation. So increasing age, male sex, specific ethnicities, different socioeconomic statuses, smoking, alcohol use, physical activity, particularly lack thereof, elevated BMI, poor sleep or obstructive sleep apnea, high triglycerides, and the list goes on and on and on. So they have multiple models here, which are beyond my statistical comprehension. But as a general rule, there are three separate models that they included here. Model one adjusted just for age and sex, and model three attempted to adjust their findings for all of these variables. I am, again, I know just enough about statistics to be dangerous, but I cannot comment on whether their adjustment was adequate, inadequate, you know, completely off the walls or whatever. That is the case in a lot of these large observational studies, but it's kind of the devil that we're working with here, the devil that we know. All right, so let's talk about the results. Again, the sample was just under half men, so 45% men. The mean age was 56. For artificial sweetener beverage consumption, 67.5% consumed 0 liters, so no artificial sweetened beverages per week. 15.3% of the study group consumed less than 1 liter, and 10.5% consumed 1 to 2 liters per week, and 6.6% consumed greater than 2 liters of artificial sweetened beverages per week. They tended to be younger, there were more women, higher BMI, and there was a greater prevalence of type 2 diabetes in the greater than 2 liter group. For sugar-sweetened beverages, almost 80% of the study population consumed no sugar-sweetened beverages per week. Again, they probably have milk, you know, sugar in their coffee, sugar in their tea, but other, you know, fizzy drinks or squash, I guess, you know, not big in this group. 8.2% consumed less than 1 liter, 6.9% consumed 1 to 2 liters, and 5.5% consumed greater than 2 liters of sugar-sweetened beverages per week. They tended to be, again, younger, in this case, male, not female, lower socioeconomic status. Again, they had higher BMI and more coronary heart disease in the group who consumed greater than 2 liters.
Okay, so with respect to AFib, the follow-up period was just under 10 years, and there was just over 9,000 cases of AFib in the study group. How they calculated risk? Well, there was no correlation between those consuming less than 1 liter or 1 to 2 liters of artificially sweetened beverages and atrial fibrillation. So what they did is they compared 0 liters, so no exposure, to consuming greater than 2 liters of artificially sweetened beverage per week. And the risk was about 20% greater in those consuming greater than 2 liters of artificially sweetened beverages per week compared to those consuming zero. For sugar-sweetened beverages, the same relationship was found, or lack thereof, I should say, meaning that there was no correlation between those consuming less than 1 liter or 1 to 2 liters per week, but rather just at greater than 2 liters of sugar-sweetened beverages per week. So when comparing no exposure to sugar-sweetened beverages to greater than 2 liters per week, the increase in risk was about 10%. Now, here's where things get interesting. We talked about them developing this polygenic risk score. And so those who had an intermediate genetic risk score, this has nothing to do with artificially sweetened beverages or sugar sweetened beverages. This is just the genetic risk alone. Well, the increase in risk was 74%. And to put that in perspective again, the risk for consuming greater than 2 liters of artificially sweetened beverages was 20%. And for those consuming greater than 2 liters per week of sugar sweetened beverages, the increase in risk for atrial fibrillation was 10%. But intermediate genetic risk alone, independent of consuming artificially sweetened beverages or sugar sweetened beverages, was 74%. And those who had a high genetic risk, well, the increase in risk was 216%. Now, they went one step further and they compared those with a low genetic risk of atrial fibrillation and consuming 0 liters of artificially sweetened beverages or sugar sweetened beverages per week to those with a high genetic risk and consuming greater than 2 liters of artificially sweetened beverages. Well, the increase in risk was 251%. And I think the comparison here, the thing we need to point out is that the genetic risk here absolutely dwarfs the effect of artificially sweetened beverages or sugar sweetened beverages on the risk of atrial fibrillation.
That's impressive. Did you know that about the genetic risk, like the magnitude of effect there?
So I wouldn't have been able to cite to you specific figures on the genetic risk. I'm certainly aware that it was a major factor. I think that my lack of intimate familiarity with those specific numbers is mainly because at this point in time, there's not much I can do about people's genetic risk for atrial fibrillation. Right. And what I'm recommending for people who either have it or who are trying to reduce their risk for it is generally the same across
the genetic
spectrum, right? Relating to things like managing obesity, diabetes, metabolic syndrome, alcohol use, and sleep apnea would be like overwhelmingly the top things that I'd be looking at for somebody who has, atrial fibrillation not due to structural heart disease.
Yeah. All right. So let's talk about the take-home messages here. So my interpretation here is that the exposure to non-nutritive sweeteners or artificial sweetened beverages is correlated to an increased risk of atrial fibrillation, not through a causal mechanism per se, but rather more by complex associations with established risk factors. So in other words, those consuming a lot of sugar-sweetened beverages or artificially sweetened beverages are more likely to have established risk factors for atrial fibrillation than those who don't. So things like a higher BMI, more type 2 diabetes, lower socioeconomic status, reduced physical activity, smoking, alcohol use, environmental exposures to pollution, and so on. It's really difficult, as I alluded to earlier with the statistical modeling, to fully adjust for these things, particularly in an observational study. I mean, you would need a bunch of randomized controlled trials to suss this out, particularly those where you knew the dosing and eliminated all the other variables to come up with a causal sort of mechanism here.
And think about the scope here. I mean, this trial that you're discussing, they had what, over 200,000 people originally included in the study. That got whittled down to, let's say, just under 150,000 people, and then they had like 9,300 cases of AFib. No way that's feasible in a randomized fashion. So prospective cohort data is the next best thing that we can have here. But I agree, there are just AFib is so complex, and it remains honestly pretty poorly understood. A lot of aspects about it remain poorly understood, but so even though some of that statistical adjustment can be useful to try to eliminate the impact of certain variables, I just don't think that we're fully there. And so any residual correlation that we see between the use of these sweeteners and AFib, I think, is much more likely to be explained by something that we haven't caught or figured out or detected yet than it is due to the ingestion of the actual sweetener itself.
Yeah. Or like I said, the correlation of those who consume artificially sweetened beverages have particular lifestyles, behaviors, et cetera, or environment and or environmental risks that, ultimately we already know about, but like the artificial sweetener itself is maybe not the smoking gun. And my rationale for that thought is that there wasn't a dose dependent relationship here. So anything less than 2 liters per week, there was no increased risk of AFib. And what you would have expected to see if there was some smoking gun, some sort of causal relationship here, is slightly increased risk at less than 1 liter compared to 0 liters, a slightly more increased risk from 1 to 2 liters compared to that, and then an even greater risk at greater than 2 liters. And that's not really what we saw here. And again, as I just, let the cat out of the bag earlier, the genetic risk dwarfs this sort of exposure. It's like, wow, okay, so that's clearly a huge, huge risk. It's not modifiable, unfortunately, but I don't think that there's good support for an artificially sweetened beverage mediated mechanism of atrial fibrillation. There's also issues with the data here. So there's no caffeine intake data here, which many people would think is a potential confounder. I'm not sold on that because the existing data on caffeine intake at typical doses, that doesn't really support that it provokes atrial fibrillation or other arrhythmias. But, you would want to know that just to cross your T's and dot your I's. Also, the intake of artificially sweetened beverages and sugar sweetened beverages in this data set was self-reported, which we know that there are issues with that. So the dosing, it's hard to come up with a prescriptive dose limitation. If somebody was like, look, I'm doing everything that you guys have recommended, all of the things, I'm trying to optimize, bro. What do I do? I wouldn't feel very confident saying, well, look, diet soda, diet drinks, if you limit them to less than 2 liters, I feel good. I just don't know that dose is representative. There, it's self-reported here. Again, it's an observational study. Also the inclusion of low calorie drinks in the artificially sweetened beverages versus no calories. I'm thinking, are these like teas, for example, that have 15 or 20 calories in them from added sugars and then some extra artificial sweeteners to make it sweet enough for people to drink? Cause that's a different deal than a no calorie food. And also the population studied is not generalizable everywhere. This is a relatively affluent sort of group in the UK. You would want to have, maybe a more diverse sample if you wanted to generalize this to everybody.
So overall, I don't think exposure to artificially sweetened beverages independently increased the risk of atrial fibrillation, though I do think it likely correlates with other risk factors that have already been established and will be, and further ones that will be established in the future at a population level. Most people consuming artificially sweetened beverages aren't doing so as part of a health-promoting dietary pattern. Most people don't need a health-promoting dietary pattern, period, right? And direct studies on artificially sweetened beverages remain generally supportive of their inclusion when they alter dietary patterns, and so far as they reduce added sugar intake, reduce overall calorie intake, but these changes may not promote actual long-term changes in the dietary pattern because, again, long-term dietary changes are relatively difficult, period. If non-nutritive sweeteners, including those that are artificial, help you better manage body weight, body fat, diabetes or metabolic syndrome, and or avoid or reduce the use of alcohol, that is likely to be far more beneficial from an atrial fibrillation risk in general than like going cold turkey and ultimately not making those changes. And again, I go back to my sort of general heuristic that at a population level, diets shouldn't be that sweet.
I agree. My comments were baked into this conclusion. So there you go.
Teamwork makes a dream work. All right. That is paper number one. Again, artificial sweeteners in atrial fibrillation. I'll link the paper in the description below.
For all the golfers in the audience, you've probably heard of PXG by seeing them on the PGA Tour in the hands of guys like Joel Damon, Zach Johnson, and Luke List. Well, they're bringing that same passion for excellence to their new line of apparel, and I gotta say, they nailed it. I just got another polo from them, and both the fit and performance are excellent. They're really versatile as well, meaning I can wear them out to eat or take a meeting without signaling to everyone that I'm about to play golf. PXG apparel has something for everyone. They got pants, polos, sweaters, hats, quarter zips, joggers, jackets, skirts, everything you could want. I've got a few of their hats and a few of their polos, but some of their mid-layers look great too. We've got a special offer for our audience. If you're looking to elevate your style game on and off the course, check out the PXG Spring and Summer 2024 collections. Head over to pxg.com/barbell and use the code barbell at checkout to save 10% on all apparel. That's pxg.com/barbell. That's code B-A-R-B-E-L-L to save 10% on apparel. That's pxg.com/barbell.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Save big money now on new siding from LP Smart Side at Menards. Update and beautify your home with your choice of 13 timeless colors of pre-finished engineered siding. It's durable and includes a Sherwin-Williams factory finish paint warranty that means no painting for years to come. View our entire selection of siding from LP Smart Side today. And don't forget to check out our flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
We're back here with Dr. Austin Baracchi on episode 282 of the Barbell Medicine Podcast, our March 2024 research review. Now we're going to talk about steroids, your favorite topic, anabolic steroids.
I suppose, right. Sure.
Yeah. The bros go crazy for this stuff. All right, so the paper is titled Mortality Among Users of Anabolic Steroids. This is a research letter published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, also known as JAMA, in March of 2024. Winfield Mathiasen is the lead author. It's a research group out of Denmark. You sent me this on Twitter, and I got so excited because I had referenced this data collection that was going on in one of our many, as you say frequently, far too many podcasts that we have on testosterone. So I was excited to see some publication out of this. Let's give you guys a little background here. AAS is an umbrella term referring to anabolic androgenic steroids. And this can obviously contains many different compounds. It's not just testosterone. It's not just, you know, nandrolone or whatever other pet steroid that you have heard about. It includes all of them. It's just an umbrella term. Anabolic refers to the skeletal muscle building properties, whereas androgenic refers to the induction and maintenance of male secondary sex characteristics, things like hair growth, deepening of the voice, and so on. Now, anabolic steroid use dates back to like 1870 when Charles Edward Brown Sequard, who's a physiologist and neurologist from Mauritius, gave himself an extract from dog and cow testicles and claimed an improvement in energy and vigor at the age of 72. Now, that's like where things started, but it's obviously expanded. That was testosterone. There are many other agents, each with their own dosing, effects, risks, et cetera, that are beyond the scope of this single podcast. But yeah, needless to say, this is a large group of different agents. As far as how many people are using anabolic androgenic steroids, we don't really know. It's difficult to get people to tell on themselves, even in an anonymous survey. It's just that the stigma surrounding these agents, not only, especially in the sports world where there's, you can get banned from sport. Yeah, most people are not willing to admit this. But still, despite all that, a 2012 survey found that around 12% of athletes would dope if it were illegal, but there were no consequences in sport. And 5% they would dope if it were legal. It would guarantee them an Olympic gold medal, but it also meant they would die within 5 years.
Glory. You got to go for it, man.
Go for gold. Two other anonymous surveys done in 2011 suggested that about 30% of competitors in the 2011 track and field world championships admitted to using PEDs within the last year. And at the 2011 Pan Arab Games, there was 45% of those survey respondents said that they had used PEDs within the last year. It's, again, really hard to come up with like solid numbers on this, but in competitive athletes, most publications will cite somewhere between 20 to 60% of all athletes are using PEDs, which corroborates some of this data we just cited. It's also pretty common in gym rats. So like not competitive athletes, some survey data suggesting over 3/4 of the men in a commercial gym have used anabolic androgenic steroids at one point in their life.
That is wild.
Totally.
That feels high. I don't know what.
How are you going to know? How are you going to find out?
Yeah.
The interesting thing here is, and we should be clear, we're not talking about TRT. And this is just a bugaboo. It just kind of annoys me. People are like, oh, I bet you're on TRT, right? I'm like, so one, testosterone replacement therapy in general is not a performance-enhancing drug unless you were hypogonadal before, like legitimately had low testosterone, and now you have, quote, normal testosterone. You've replaced the testosterone you should have already had. And so, yeah, it's a PED for somebody who has a medical condition. Austin, you also brought up a great point that if somebody had, like, low testosterone due to very high training volumes or whatever, and they went on a quote TRT level dose, that might actually be a PED for them. We don't know that to be the case, but that's just a hypothesis.
Yeah,
but
it's performance enhancing relative to the disease state, right? If you had this like raging severe insomnia and you performed poorly as a result, and then we just like got you to sleep better or gave you a sleeping pill, suddenly that's a PED relative to being in terrible shape. That's very different than being fine at baseline and then using something to boost your performance well above what you were physiologically capable of at baseline.
Yeah, but to be clear, when we're talking about this study and AAS use, so anabolic androgenic steroids, we're not talking about TRT. So the doses that people use, particularly in sport and obviously in gym rats, and I use that term affectionately because you guys are my homies, but it just, you know, it's understood who I'm talking about. The doses are high. In a review of 500 anonymous anabolic androgenic steroid users, 78% of whom were non-competitive bodybuilders or non-athletes, almost 60% reported administering at least 1 gram, that's 1,000 milligrams, of testosterone or its equivalent per week. To put that in perspective, that's about 5 times the sort of like what I would consider a normal or maybe even normal high dose of testosterone replacement therapy. And of those admitting or saying that they used over 1,000 milligrams of testosterone per week, 25% of them reported using human growth hormone and insulin for their anabolic effects on top of that. 99% of the survey group also reported side effects from anabolic androgenic steroid use. These are high doses. This is, again, it's not TRT.
Yeah, that's completely unsurprising. But, you know, if we're talking to the kind of people who are like, yeah, I would take this if it gave me a gold medal and I died the next year, then they're not really going to be as concerned with the side effects from this. So.
True. Yeah, totally. Speaking of side effects and harms, so it's just been hard to assess long-term deleterious effects or harms from anabolic androgenic steroid use. So one, you got to identify groups of people that are using them and then following them for a long time. That's logistically challenging right off the bat. Again, not only do people not want to quote tell on themselves, but like follow up is just difficult. Like, how are you just going to keep in contact and with a large enough group of people to be representative to actually have something to report? So most of the stuff is just case reports, right? And again, also people use different agents. So there are different types of anabolic androgenic steroids that use them at different doses for different durations of time. And they have various different baseline health statuses, including genetic sort of predispositions, so different ages, underlying mental health, and so on. It's just hard to do. So basically up until now, most of the studies on what we would consider high dose anabolic androgenic steroid use has been case reports. That's effectively what we've had. So this study is pretty unique and then identified a relatively large group of individuals using anabolic androgenic steroids and compared them to controls in the same country, age matched, over a relatively long follow-up period of 11 years. So I was pumped when this thing got published. I'm like, yeah, I thought this thing was going to be, you know, a 20-page write-up describing harm reduction in sport and, you know, whatever. It's a 2-page research letter. So I was ultimately let down, but let's talk about it anyway. So the study, this was done by the group Anti-Doping Denmark. This is a Danish anti-doping agency supported by the Danish government who was involved in research, education, doping control, and so on in an effort to, quote, fight against doping in sport. So they work with chains of commercial gyms in Denmark, which that's voluntary for the gyms to actually participate. The gyms decide whether or not they want to work with the Anti-Doping Denmark group. If they decide to work with them, they have to show a smiley face on the entrance to the gym. And if they don't want to work with the Anti-Doping Denmark group, they have to show a sad face on the entrance to the gym.
Bizarre.
I've trained in Denmark, and I cannot recall if there was smiley face or sad faces, but now I kind of want to go back just to find out, like, what gym was I training at?
Yeah, we'll have to ping some of our contacts over there and see where they train.
Yeah. So if the gym chooses to participate, they get a visit from two of these Anti-Doping Denmark officials about once or twice a year, and they will look around the gym for, as they describe, suspicious people, and then take them to the bathroom where they have to give a urine sample. So a positive test for anabolic androgenic steroids will result in a 2-year ban from any of the gyms that are working with the ADD, the Anti-Doping Denmark group, and refusing to give a urine sample counts as a positive. So that's just a right off the bat. What would you do, Austin, if you were, I mean, I guess you're in your home gym, so somebody would have to like turn up, yeah. Whatever.
Yeah, more so what I'm imagining is like, imagine trying to implement something like this in the United States. Not to say that we're advocating that this should be implemented, but like no chance that this gets off the ground in the US. It would immediately be met with pretty furious resistance among a certain segment of our population here, I think.
Yeah, well, you would think there'd have to be some sort of financial incentive to like big chain gyms, right? Like, hey, we'll give you some sort of either tax credit or some sort of, you know, financial support and or, you know, some marketing that it helps you market. I don't know.
I still don't think that would work, honestly. I think you could offer them all the financial incentives in the world. And then as soon as they're like, yeah, so we're going to let these like, you know, strangers come in the gym and look for quote unquote suspicious people and like spot test that, like, there's just no way this works here.
Yeah. I wonder how they enforce that though, right? They're like, oh, you pop positive, you can't come back to this gym. Do they have like, you know, like biometric scanning? Like, oh, dude, he's right. Trying to go to the gym. Go get him.
Yeah. The American brain cannot comprehend this.
No, yeah. Yeah, fair enough. So the study included Danish men who received a doping sanction of 2 years, again, by a drug testing in the gym between 2006 and 2018. They compared those individuals who popped positive with 50 other age-matched controls. So during this period of time, between 2006 and 2018, just over 1,000 men were popped for using anabolic androgenic steroids. And they included just under 60,000 controls to compare them to. There was a mean follow-up of 11 years. So the follow-up either occurred until death, migration out of the country, or until the cutoff for publication of the study, which was June 30th of 2023. The average age of both groups was 27.4, but there's no other health data really available. I was just curious. I was like, I wonder if there's some sort of underlying factor you can identify that predisposes folks to like use, you know, do they have a lower BMI or something or higher BMI? I don't know. I'd be curious.
Okay, so the results. Of the 1,189 anabolic androgenic steroid users, 33 of them died during the follow-up period. And of the 59,450 controls, 578 died. So it was a much higher percentage of people that died during the follow-up period who were using steroids compared to the controls. And this represents an increased risk of about 181% for those who are using anabolic androgenic steroids compared to the controls of all-cause mortality. Now, within those deaths, some were deemed unnatural, like accidents primarily, and others were deemed due to natural causes, so things like cancer, cardiovascular disease, and so on. In the group that was doping, there were 17 unnatural causes of death and 16 natural causes. And in the controls, there was 208 unnatural causes, again, like accidents, and 334 natural causes of death. Now, the big takeaway here that what you're getting so far is that there's a huge increase in risk of all-cause mortality from the use of anabolic androgenic steroids, at 181% increased risk of all-cause mortality. But the overall, the absolute risk of death in both groups was quite low. It was 1.1% approximately in controls and about 4.5% during the follow-up period overall, which actually stretched out to about 18 years, although the average follow-up was just over 11 years. So my takeaway here, and again, I want to be clear that we're talking about those using anabolic androgenic steroids, likely at high doses. This is not testosterone replacement therapy. Is this correlation just pure correlation, or is it causal? So to start out, I think there's some important confounders that I would like to kind of point out before I kind of give my ultimate summary. First is the probability of polypharmacy. So just using more than one different agent. I have been in the gym industry for a long time. I've been in strength sports for a while. I've been in, like, you know, physique adjacent sort of circles for a while. I am somewhat familiar with the types of steroid cycles that people run. It is relatively rare for people to use one agent at a time. They usually use at least two, sometimes up to five, six over the course of an entire cycle. Polypharmacy is a big risk here. So, and just like when you treat patients, Austin, having more agents on board, more drugs on board, it's not that it's, you know, necessarily riskier compared to not treating them in your case with the patients, but there's risk of interactions there for sure. Also, we don't know the doses here. And again, I take you back to the background information I was giving you, but the doses are likely to be high. You know, that survey suggested that, you know, almost 2/3 of individuals were taking more than 1,000 milligrams of testosterone per week, which is a very high dose, right? So it's likely they're using high doses, multiple different agents, and people aren't getting these from pharmacies, right? They're not just walking down. Look, if the Danish people have, you know, these men in black coming into the gym and randomly testing suspicious people, you think they have pharmacies on each corner saying, ah, oh, you want some testosterone? You want some oxandrolone? You want some nandrolone? Like, no. So people, it's difficult for people to obtain the stuff that they want. And so, and I, in general, I don't trust the ethics of people dealing illicit drugs. It's not a value, a moral judgment. It's just like, look, man, do you have a mass spectrometer like in your place, you know, liquid gas chromatography that you can analyze your yield here of making these things? So contamination is a big risk. These people may be involved in other risky behaviors. That's been pretty well established. And they could have had pre-existing disease. So I don't, those are all confounders. So to me, this is not exactly a slam dunk for causality, but it's also hard to feel confident that high dose PED use is harmless. I think the risks are likely proportional to the dose, the agent, or many different agents that are being used, and duration of use. So higher dose, more agents, longer use, likely proportional increase in risk. Monitoring for like side effects or like, you know, indicative lab changes indicative of like a health condition is probably underutilized. Mainly, there's like a lot of stigma here, right? There's this veil of secrecy that people who are using anabolics or using performance enhancing drugs have to do this behind. There's stigma by the public, there's stigma in sport. Although in some circles, and maybe there's a positive stigma, it's like, oh, bro, you're on now, you're on the pump. Nice, right? That's a relatively small fraction of the population. And because of these things, there's been relatively little research here, right? So Austin, if you were working in the primary care setting and you had patients that came in or like, hey, I'm using this, 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 and this at these doses, here's how long I'm going to use them for. There'd be no resource for you to go to be like, yeah, here's how we should monitor that. You would be guessing, and it would be an educated guess. It would be better than, in general, a bro guessing at this. But because there's not been a lot of research into these things at these doses that people are clearly using at relatively, you know, high frequencies in certain populations, you just don't know. That'd be a very difficult for you to do a good job there.
Yeah, that's effectively, I mean, I have had some patients that I've consulted with via telemedicine, some who I've seen more in the routine, like hospital setting and stuff like that. But yeah, I don't have nearly enough familiarity with these things to be super confident in that. I'm like, okay, I should probably assess your cardiovascular risk, your lipids, your blood pressure, your liver function, maybe your kidneys and blood sugar, blood lipids, things like that. That's, you know, and make sure your hematocrit's not getting too high. that's probably about as far as I can confidently say off the bat, but like compound specific considerations or dosing or how to guide somebody off of these things, it's like, yeah, I'm not your guy, unfortunately.
Yeah.
I mean, go ahead.
Well, think about all the changes we know that happens to routine blood work just via exercise, right? Or like creatine use, right? That could potentially happen. Imagine now the complexity from like using not only high dose testosterone, but also like, again, other agents, oxandrolone, nandrolone, whatever, you know, so on and so on, insulin, human growth hormone, like, and then combining them all together. And you're like, is this like a quote normal level based on what you're doing? Like, what sort of risk does this impart upon you? And so effectively you're guessing, it's an educated guess, like I said, and you're coming up with some sort of contract. You're like, hey, look, patient X, if your liver function tests get to this level, I think we should agree to come off these agents because, well, I don't know this to be the case, it seems probable, or you know, perhaps more likely than not, that you're going to have some health issues. And getting them to agree is another thing, but effectively, that's the best you can do, I feel like.
Yeah, I'm never really in a position where I'm trying to force somebody down that path, but rather like upfront, I'm asking them like, what do you want from me? Like, why are you consulting with me? And if they're like, well, I want some guidance to do this safely, okay, that's an easy conversation to have. If they're like, I'm using this no matter what, I don't really care what you think, or I just want to get checked or something, then I might check it and might initiate a conversation, but not push too hard into it because I'm there to consult with them, not to, you know, be their parent over this kind of stuff. I mean, I look at the data that you've presented, you know, and that was discussed in this paper showing like some risk, but like you said, a lot of other things to be considered, and overall not super confident that this is causing all the harm or that it's harmless either. And ultimately the way I came away after listening to this is just that it's kind of hard to kill 27-year-olds, you know, like I see a lot of people in my clinical work who are not on high dose, you know, anabolic steroids across the full age spectrum, and the amount of disease burden and complexity and critical illness that people can like survive and get through. I'm just, sometimes I see some of my patients and I'm like, how are you alive right now? You have like end stage multi-organ failure or something like that. And they're still, and I go and talk to them and like, doc, I feel great, you know? And so the idea that I have that you could have 27-year-olds who are using steroids and they don't die at an overwhelming rate is like probably what I would have predicted at baseline, you know, that it takes a lot for somebody who, especially who is young, to die prematurely.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I've gotten a number of questions in my DMs and such, which also, by the way, if you DM me about like you very unique health conditions, it is hard for me to respond intelligently other than to say we would need more information under a, like, you know, in a medical setting where I would actually have like follow-up responsibility and liability and such for I can't just give you advice, right? But people are like, hey, is there any risk with like short duration anabolic exposure as a young person? I'm paraphrasing in a very technical manner, but I'm like, dude, I can't tell you that. I can't tell you that there's no risk, but I also don't want to like scare people and say, oh, there's a huge risk. I don't want to blow that out of proportion. We just don't really know. And which brings me to my larger point about like sort of the PED use and science communicators in this space. The very best people on this are very, very humble in their opinions and remain skeptical of any confident claims. They don't generally make them outside of like, we don't really know. So when I find people talking about dosing, you know, lab monitoring, using different agents together in a very confident manner, I'm like, yeah, this is all made up. And I think exercising some caution in how people talk about this would be beneficial. Because I think if the person who's maybe on the fence about this or has been considering it or is even using right now, if they were aware of like, yeah, we don't really know a whole lot about this, and there's a lot of uncertainty, I think it would be hard to feel confident that what somebody's doing is, you know, health promoting, for example, or not that risky. They would just be like, well, I don't know, and I'm okay with that risk, you know, understanding the magnitude of that risk just due to uncertainty.
Yeah, I'm with you. I mean, I think that we've talked about testosterone itself at length before. And in general, I think that, you know, we see things at both ends of the spectrum. But in general, you know, the routine use of testosterone is quite safe, honestly. It's just a matter of what are the specific trade-offs for the specific person, and do they want to be like committed to the indefinite use of it? For example, if they give themselves testosterone-induced, you know, hypogonadism or, you know, infertility or something like that, which are things that not everybody has thought of when they're going into those
benefits. It's a benefit.
Yeah, but you know, and so similarly, not in the exact same, you know, way, but similarly, we're trying to be accurate with portraying what we can confidently say at this point about potential risks and potential benefits. And it's just really hard to do that with the existing data, but definitely don't want to blow things out of proportion either.
Yeah. There are no biological free lunches. I just don't know how much it's going to cost.
Yeah. So. I mean, there are even clinical scenarios where these drugs are used. We've talked about it before, you know, prescription of oxandrolone or testosterone in the context of, you know, advanced wasting diseases and things like that. And so we don't want to portray it of like, oh, if this person with like AIDS cachexia goes on oxandrolone, they're going to die from their steroid. It's like, that might actually be very good for them in that particular context. Maybe still an individual, you know, case by case basis. So
what was that paper I sent you? This must have been, oh man, I feel like it was like 8 years ago, but it was like, it was either nandrolone use for like, coronary heart disease or something in women, or like either it was that or like testosterone, one of the testosterone.
I vaguely remember this, and it felt like a stretch at the time. I don't know if there's been follow up data on that.
Yeah. All right, moving on. Third and final paper here on the March 2024 research review here with Dr. Baraki is on plastics, and this paper is titled "Microplastics and Nanoplastics in Atheromas and Cardiovascular Events." This was written by Marfella et al. And a research group from Italy. It was published in the New England Journal of Medicine, March 2024. All right, so let's give you guys some background here. There are a lot of plastics in the world, and when they're degraded, they can form microplastics, which is defined as something smaller than 5 millimeters, or nanoplastics, which is something that is less than 1,000 nanometers in size. And also, to be clear, plastics is a generic term. There's no single component or chemical composition within plastic that is like, oh yeah, this is decidedly plastic. But these in general are synthetic or semi-synthetic compositions, usually made from petrochemicals that can be molded or shaped. Most plastics are insoluble in water, so they're pretty stable and relatively chemically inert until you like heat them, damage them, shake them around, pressurize them, etc. According to a World Health Organization statement, micro and nanoplastic particles larger than 150 micrometers are not absorbed into the blood and do not penetrate blood vessels. So in general, we're talking about really small stuff. Now, data in human studies have shown micro and nanoplastic particles smaller than this have been detected in tissue samples from the liver, the placenta, and lungs of healthy adults, also found in breast milk, urine, and whole blood, again, in healthy adults. Plastics are everywhere, but they have to be small enough to enter the body and stick around. All right. As far as how plastics get into our body, it's usually via ingestion, but can also be through inhalation and skin exposure. Plastics, again, are everywhere in the environment. Previous studies using the same technology used in this particular study showed that polyethylene, which is a type of plastic, was found in about 25% of whole blood samples derived from healthy volunteers. So people are just walking around with plastics in their blood with no apparent effects. Now, observational data from occupational exposure studies, these are people working with plastics at their job, suggest that there's an increased risk of cardiovascular disease amongst these persons who are exposed to things like PVC in their occupation. I don't think this is just handling PVC, like, oh, you work, you know, you're unloading, loading, stuff like that, but more like the creation of PVC. And there's, you know, different OSHA requirements. I'm not well versed in how that all goes down, but it does seem to be that if you're exposed to this in the manufacturing process, maybe there's an increased risk of cardiovascular disease. That's still some new emerging data here. As far as how it might promote disease, we think it's via this oxidative stress inflammation type pathway, but it's overall unclear as to how this affects humans health-wise. So this study set out to explore whether micro and nanoplastic particles are detectable within atherosclerotic plaque in the carotid, and whether this burden of plastics in those plaques is associated with cardiovascular disease. All right, so the study was in 312 patients with asymptomatic carotid artery stenosis. Austin, can you give people a lay of the land? Like, what is carotid artery stenosis, and why is it important that it's asymptomatic?
Yeah, we've talked a lot about cardiovascular disease before, atherosclerosis, plaques, and how you can develop these cholesterol-laden plaques in various parts of your vascular system. Most relevant for things like heart attacks is when it's in the little arteries that feed your heart, but they can also accumulate in other arteries feeding other parts of your body. And so in the same way that people can have these plaques in their coronary arteries of their heart and not necessarily have any symptoms of it, that would be considered asymptomatic coronary artery disease or coronary artery atherosclerosis. You can have similar plaques developing in your carotid arteries. Those are the big arteries that feed blood up to your brain and can similarly develop these same types of cholesterol-laden plaques there. When they are not significantly large or obstructive and relatively stable, then they would not really cause any impact on the person's quality of life. They wouldn't feel it. They wouldn't notice it. If they can get progressively more and more and more narrowed, that can gradually lead to some complications. Or suddenly, if there's a sudden breakage or rupture of these things, that can lead to things like a stroke. If pieces of that plaque get sent upwards into the brain, they can get lodged in your arteries. And so there are certain, procedures or interventions that are sometimes done to evaluate carotid artery plaque, carotid artery stenosis, and sometimes procedures done to open those vessels up. Those are relatively uncommon compared with, how often we need to go in and deal with things in the heart or in the legs. But it's something that is sometimes necessary in the context of patients who are having certain symptoms or who are having strokes due to those plaques in their arteries. So in this case, it was patients who had some of this plaque in their neck arteries, but did not have any symptoms of it or were not showing signs of it.
Yep. Yep. And so these patients, they underwent a carotid endarterectomy, which is surgical removal of the plaque, and the specimens of the plaque were assessed for micro and nanoplastics of 11 different types. They also looked at the incidence of non-fatal heart attacks, non-fatal strokes, or death in those with the micro and nanoplastic particles in the plaque specimen compared to those who had no micro or nanoplastic particles in their plaques. Okay, results time. So of those who underwent this carotid endarterectomy, 8 had a stroke or died before discharge, so they were removed from the sample. 47 were lost due to follow-up. So of the 257 remaining, they were followed up for just under 3 years. It's about 33 months. 58.4% had detectable plastic in the plaque specimen. 12.1% had PVC, polyvinyl chloride, found in the specimen that was analyzed. Of note, again, they analyzed for 11 different types of plastic, and they only found these two. Now, the average amount of plastic found in each plaque was 21.7 micrograms per milligram plaque. And those with plastic in the plaque specimen, they tended to be younger, they tended to be men, they tended to have more type 2 diabetes, more cardiovascular disease, more dyslipidemia, that's abnormal cholesterol levels, and tended to be smokers. Now, with respect to outcomes, again, that was non-fatal heart attack, non-fatal stroke, or death. They compared those who had the micro nanoplastic particles compared to those who had no micro nanoplastic particles. In those who had no micro nanoplastic particles, there were 8 events. So 7.5% of their study sample had an event within the next 3 years. And there were 30 events in those with micro nanoplastic particles in their plaque specimen. So about 20% of that group had an event in the 3-year follow-up period. Now, this represents an increased risk of about 353%, but I want to draw your attention to this sort of statistical term called confidence intervals. Now, the confidence interval ranges from 2 to 10.27. Now, that is a wide confidence interval, which makes it hard to tell the size of the effect, the magnitude of the sort of risk here, though the fact that there is a risk is still, established by this data set. You just don't know how big the actual effect is.
Yeah, you can be more confident in the directionality of effect, but less confident in the magnitude of that effect. And that is still, all of that is separate from whether this is causal or not. Because again, this is similarly like an observational kind of finding here, an association of risk. So yeah.
Yep. Last thing I'll say is that of the plastics that were found in the atheromatous plaque, they were all nanoplastics, which less than 200 nanometers in size. So pretty small stuff. So my interpretation of this was interesting. When you sent me this paper, I go, bro, what? Like I was aware that there's other data showing that, and sometimes in healthy human tissue, there's plastics in there. But in general, those studies were, again, in healthy folks, or they were in folks that had an existing disease, but they had no comparator group to say, oh yeah, and the folks who didn't have plastics in their tissue didn't have this disease. So we don't really know. This is the first time I've seen something with an actual comparator group in living humans. And that were followed up after the sample was obtained. Also, I found it interesting that only 2 of the 11 plastics tested for were actually found. You would expect, is there something unique to these plastics, or are they just the most commonly found ones? I don't know. I'm not a materials expert here.
Yeah, me neither. I would have expected if all of the 11 that they selected are relatively prevalent in like industrial use and consumer products, you might expect to find like a smattering of these things. But maybe there's differences in their propensity to find themselves in plaque, because this finding isn't that these things were nowhere to be found in these people's bodies, but rather in the specific plaque that was surgically removed from their neck artery. So maybe there's some advanced chemistry going on there of like, you know, polyethylene or PVC might be, you know, more prone to chemically react with some substance in plaque, whereas the other types of plastics might be less likely to deposit there and more someplace else. We don't really know.
Yeah. Imagine if you were like, oh yeah, the anionic charge here wouldn't in vivo, like attracts these things to, you know, areas of turbulence, like, okay.
Yeah. If I felt like going back to my chemistry roots, that would be an interesting topic to get into.
Yeah. Now there are a number of limitations to the study in addition to it being observational. That's just thing one. We don't know. We cannot imply causation via this. But apparently when they were preparing, when they were obtaining and then, you know, transferring the samples and like preparing them and everything, they weren't using clean rooms, which I think would really there's a substantial risk of contamination. I mean, obviously when people are being surgerized, the whole room, the surgical field is sterile, but I don't know that you can actually perform surgery in a clean room, so to speak. Yeah. So that would be difficult.
And there's a fair amount of plastic used in various medical supplies and equipment and stuff like that, too.
Yeah. No socioeconomic data either, which you would probably want to have if you were trying to figure out, like, is there some sort of environmental exposure, that we can identify or at least hypothesize about? And then variables for dietary exposure were not included. And I think this and the environmental factors, so things at work or in the community, are likely what most people are interested in, especially if they caught wind of this. They're like, well, should I not buy anything in plastic anymore? Should I not microwave my food in plastic? Like, what's the deal? Like, that's where people's brains immediately go. And I think they probably couldn't do this in the study setting, right? And so definitely room for further research. But I think it's hard. It's going to be hard to give people the answers they want based on the study. Did you see any other limitations in the data set that you were like, I don't love this?
Yeah, I think just in general that the design of this study is hypothesis generating more than anything else, right? Mm-hmm. And so I don't really care too much further about nitpicking additional limitations outside of, oh, this is interesting. This is something that's worth looking into. But I'm not going to go much further than that in terms of drawing conclusions off of this.
Yeah. Yeah. So take home. This is where you get in trouble. You read an observational study when there's not a whole bunch of other data around there to really shape your thoughts. And then you're like, so anyway, here are my recommendations. Here's the barbell medicine protocol for micro and nanoparticle.
Oh God, it's protocol time. Okay.
It's protocol time. Yeah, that's right. To be clear, I am not sure what to make of this, right? Especially if we even narrow the lens for like plastics exposure, again, plastics being a generic term, but if we narrow the focus to just heart disease. Because plastic exposure has been going up precipitously, particularly in recent years, but the rate of cardiovascular disease has been going down. So like if you zoom out far enough, you're like, oh, maybe plastics is actually reducing risk of cardiovascular disease, which is not true, but you could generate an observational study that would show that sort of relationship.
Yeah.
I think, you know, before we came on air, we kind of had a little discussion about this and I agree with you. It's like, I think in general, like avoiding excessive exposure to plastics seems like a reasonable idea. I don't know why necessarily, other than like, I guess I would want to avoid that. If I had to make a strong case for avoiding it, I would say, well, look, we have some data showing that particulate matter 2.5 and particulate matter 10, these are the size of the micron, like the size of the actual particulate matter. These have been, you know, said to be a cardiovascular disease risk factor in recent years due to environmental exposure, like pollution and such. Okay, so maybe plastics are in that same vein, like a particulate matter. Maybe that's harmful. I don't know. But I would probably want to limit exposure to these things that I'm unclear are potentially harmful, but I don't know yet. I guess that's more just being risk averse than like feeling confident that we should do everything possible outside, you know, within your power to reduce risk. I don't know if I feel that strongly about it, but I'm thinking mostly about air quality, occupational exposure, things like that. I guess lower hanging fruit, like if you're getting blasted in the face with particulate matter at work, would probably want to wear a respirator. You know, I'm like, these are not, I'm not changing the game here, so to speak. But regarding lifestyle, I think the biggest question people have here is about kind of food ingestion. So like microwaving food in plastic containers, whether it's Tupperware, pouches, to-go containers, and so on, versus using glass, ceramic, or similar, even like buying foods. Like, oh, this one came in a box versus this one came in, you know, I had to hand pick it. Like, I don't know, you know, something like that for plastic. I don't know on that either. I mean, most plastics are insoluble in water. They're pretty stable and chemically inert unless you heat them a bunch or pressurize them a lot. There's been a lot of talk about like BPA, that's bisphenol A, that's an additive for clear plastics to make them hard, or phthalates, which are added to plastic to make them soft and pliable. You can find BPA-free stuff. You can find stuff that's phthalate-free. I mean, that's reasonable. They're said to be endocrine disruptors, but there's little direct evidence showing that despite their ubiquity in the environment, that they actually are causing effect. Food packaging materials must pass standards set by the FDA under the Food Contact Notification Program to be labeled safe. And some are skeptical of that. I get that. Like the American Chemistry Society is like, they're making the recommendations to the FDA, but they also, you know, represent a bunch of food, you know, related interests, food industry related industries and groups. And so I'm like, I can see the skepticism there. But despite all these quote endocrine disruptors in the, you know, in the world, average testosterone levels haven't been going down over time, for example. So like, and people say, oh, what about fertility? I'm like, well, these are more complex questions. You know, when you talk about fertility, you talk about testosterone levels, you talk about other sort of medical conditions. Yes, like health status has changed, age, you know, average age has changed. And yes, I'm not going to deny environmental exposure stuff has changed, but I just don't know that it's plastic stuff. So when it comes to me, plastics versus glass for like food preparation and stuff, I don't think it's a huge deal for most, but if it makes you feel better to use glass over plastic, like go for it. I'm probably more concerned with the plastics already in the food or the food supply in general and in the environment than like happen to nuke, you know, some rice in a Tupperware that happens to be plastic. But if you have glass and you feel better about that, that's great. That's fine. I just think that the environmental stuff or the things that are already in the food supply are probably a bigger exposure, maybe bigger fish to fry to the extent that we think these may be risky. I just don't know that.
Yeah, I have similar conclusions. I think that it's would be wise to not eat plastics or to breathe plastics. That's a that's going to be my recommendation is don't eat plastic. But you know, I look back at some of these data, and for example, of the patients, you know, you reported some of the patients who had some of the plastic identified in the plaques. They were tended to be people who had more diabetes, cardiovascular disease, cholesterol issues, and were smokers. And so, you know, I'm like, sure, we can talk at length about reducing exposure to plastics if we wanted to based on hypothetical mechanisms. But if you really wanted to reduce your cardiovascular risk, not having diabetes, cholesterol issues, and smoking, the effect of those things, I suspect, will likely dwarf the effect of mitigating plastics exposure in your individual life. You know, you mentioned certain other potential sources of exposure, be it occupational, environmental, things like that. And admittedly, I think those are perfectly valid things to think about, to look into, potentially even to intervene upon, be it in the occupational setting or out in the world. But that's really difficult to mitigate on an individual level, personally, right? And so unless you're willing to be in favor of wholesale, broad regulatory changes, which again, as we've talked about before, with the food environment and things like that, and the, you know, socio-political context in the U.S., like broad regulation of these things, there's a lot of aversion to that kind of thing. There's a lot of interests that are at play, ranging from the petroleum industry that leads to the production of plastics to various other, you know, players kind of in the game. And so I agree with you. I think that if it makes somebody feel better or safer to reduce their exposure to these things in their day-to-day life, assuming that they're not eating plastic, but, you know, making those minor, you know, substitutions, like you said, glass for plastic, I think that's fine. But I agree that the likelihood of that being the variable that leads to you having a heart attack or stroke or not is very, very, very unlikely to be significant compared with the variables that were mentioned above: smoking, diabetes, you know, obesity, things like that, and other factors that you are less in control of, be it the overall food supply, the overall environmental exposure, which, you know, if you want that to change, you might have to change how you're voting or something like that. I don't know, but that's a bigger question.
I mean, my biggest thing here is they didn't correct for cadmium exposure with the cigarette smokers, because, you know, potential confounder. No, you know, it'd be interesting. Like, what if they found that, like, wearing that cloth mask outside reduced, you know, particulate exposure by some, you know, disease modifying effect proportion? Hey, look, if you wear this cloth mask in public due to our environment, you're, you know, 20% less likely to have cardiovascular disease due to exposure of X, Y, and Z.
you think?
Yeah, or if it showed the same degree of risk reduction in cardiovascular disease as potential plastic exposure here led to a risk increase. In other words, yeah. The magnitude of effect was the exact same, but the intervention and directionality were opposite. That is an interesting thought experiment that we'll probably have to leave people with here.
That's what I'm saying, because people would be like, yeah, to get plastics out of our food. And it's like, yeah, but you can do this intervention to like completely eliminate that because we can't change the food supply. I'm like, no, I will not do that. Yeah, think about that at home. Let us know what you think. All right, that is a wrap here on episode 282 of the Barbell Medicine Podcast. This is our March 2024 research review. Special thank you to Dr. Austin Baracchi. He's ever so generous with his time. But before you guys go anywhere, please leave us a 5-star rating and a review wherever you get this podcast from. It really helps drive traffic to our podcast so we can keep bringing you all the latest nuance in health and fitness. From everyone here at Barbell Medicine, I'm Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you next week and every week right here on the Barbell Medicine Podcast.